Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 45. Hello, you're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy Show, the view from my side of the cockpit door. I'm Captain Jeff, your host, broadcasting live from Studio 619 at the Club Quarters Hotel in beautiful San Francisco, California. On today's show, laser glasses, the crashing of a perfectly good 727, a bad joke prompts the evacuation of an airport, your feedback, and much, much more. So get all settled in, tray tables and seat backs in their upright and locked positions, electronic devices powered on, Flight 45 is ready for pushback. Hello again and welcome to the Airline Pilot Guy Show. Aviation news and commentary all from the perspective of a line-flying active airline pilot flying for a major U.S. legacy airline. And I'm in San Francisco, California. Man, it's been a long time since I've flown into San Francisco. Used to fly in here quite often in the 727 and the L-1011. But since I've been on the MD-88, MD-90, I haven't been out here. So it's quite a treat for me to head out to this beautiful city on by the bay. I'm on day two of a four-day trip last night in Omaha, Nebraska. And let's see, tomorrow we'll end up laying over in Tampa and then finally home on Friday. First thing I'd like to do on today's show is to apologize because I thought I was so smart. I was so smug, wasn't I? Thinking that I had caught up with all of my feedback. Well, apparently I didn't do a good enough job of syncing my Evernote applications between computers. I have it on my iPhone, I have it on my MacBook Pro and my MacBook. And apparently several pieces of feedback were dropped out of the queue. So I hope to make up for that today and read your feedback, the feedback that I missed on last week's show. And I think Peter Doyle took me up on that advice that if you don't hear me reading or playing your feedback, then resend it. And he did that. And thank you, Peter. And I'll try not to let this happen again, let all this stuff fall through the cracks. But hey, last week's show was a shorter show. You know, it was a little over an hour. And then the previous two were over 2 hours. I'm not sure how long today's show is going to be, but I'm going to try to make it as quick and snappy as I can. So let's get on with it, shall we? Okay, now, last episode, I was in Pensacola, Florida, and if you'll remember, while I was recording the podcast, I was talking about perhaps meeting with Steve, and he's in Pensacola, or actually he's in Perdido Key, between Pensacola and Mobile, and he sent me feedback a few times, and he kind of chided me for not calling him when I was in Pensacola the last time. And so this time I said, okay, I'm going to make sure that I call up Steve. And I did that, and it just worked out timing-wise that he could head over to Pensacola and join me for a beer and dinner at McGuire's Irish Pub, which is literally across the street from the hotel in which we stay in Pensacola. And so it was great. You know, I've done this before, having met with a listener. You know, you remember Chris in Manchester, New Hampshire, I met with last month, and then we had a great time. And Steve and I also had a great time. And speaking of Steve, he sent me some feedback after our dinner. And thank you again, Steve, for treating me to a wonderful dinner. Those hamburgers at the McGuire's Irish Pub were fantastic. And he wrote to me and said, hey, I really enjoyed getting together last night. Let's do it again soon. I mentioned that I was going to add a voiceover to my videos, so I tried it last night. And here's the link. See what you think. Okay, so I'm going to head over here to my SoundBite playing application and play the video that Steve added some voice commentary. Here we go.
Hello, this is Pilot Steve with the first annotated version of one of my videos made while flying. Just to give you a little background, I'm just a private pilot. Been flying for 30, 35 years and never was in the military, just decided to learn to fly on my own. What I thought I'd do is, for those of you not familiar with general aviation, is to go along with these podcasts or video casts, is to kind of give you a little narration of what's going on and give you a little perspective of what general aviation is like and what we have to do to fly. And just real quickly here, that's the takeoff roll. I've already done a run-up, and I'll explain that in another video cast. But the particular plane I'm flying, which is a Corvallis Cessna 400, we have a rotate speed of around 80 knots. So as soon as I see 80 knots, I pull back on the stick and bring the nose up, and if everything's working right, we take right on off. And here I took off to the east and had a traffic landing, so I was trying to get out of the pattern fairly quick. So my course was back.
Okay, you get the idea behind these. I'll have a link to Steve's video, YouTube video, in the show notes. And he's sounding just like an airline pilot, isn't he? And that's what I do, too. Really nice job, Steve. And again, really enjoyed sharing a beer and dinner with you at McGuire's in Pensacola. We'll have to do it again sometime. In fact, he said next time, if you have a little bit more time, we'll go flying. That'd be a lot of fun. And so anyway, check that out. So let me go back over here, see what else we have here on my list of things. Lots of things, actually. Okay, here we go. I don't know if somebody sent this to me or not, but some dude in Anchorage, Alaska, the main terminal of Anchorage's largest airport, was evacuated Sunday after a man made comments about a bomb, which he later said was meant to be taken as a joke. Police at the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport took the matter seriously and arrested Peter Friesema on charges of making terroristic threats and disorderly conduct. He was jailed at the Anchorage Correctional Complex with bail set at $5,000. So, just a word to the wise, don't fool around. You know, you see those signs all over the place. Don't joke about having a bomb or a gun or something like that, because guess what? You're going to get in trouble, and you're going to be inconvenienced, and you're probably going to be out of pocket a lot of money. Okay, let's see. I was sent some feedback from somebody regarding Alaska. Trying to stay on the same topic. Here we go. Feedback about Anchorage. Hello, Captain Jeff. My name is Andy Knight from Anchorage, Alaska, and I discovered your podcast on Stitcher about 6 months ago. Great podcast. Thanks. I work on the North Slope of Alaska in the oil and gas industry, and I save your podcast to listen to while at work for 2 weeks at a time. I want to thank you for putting out such a great podcast. Thanks. By the way, I would like to make a donation to help you with the cost of making your show. How should I do that? Okay, I haven't set anything up yet for donations and such, but I appreciate that that offer. And just as soon as I have something like that, I'll let you know. Anyways, I have a million questions, but I'll ask just one for now. Have you ever flown into Anchorage International? If so, what do you think? Having flown in and out of Lake Hood many times and in light bush planes, I always find it amazing that there's not mid-air collisions all the time, since Lake Hood, Lake Hood Strip, and Stevens International are all so close to each other. I remember one time when I was with a friend in his 180 coming in to land at the Lake Hood Strip, and I look to the right and see a float plane coming in to land on the lake, and to his right, an Alaska Airlines 737 landing at the Anchorage International. The airspace is very stressful for the general aviation guys, at least. Anyways, I hate writing emails on my phone, so I'll let you go. Any thoughts on Anchorage? Thanks again, Andy. Andy, thanks for your feedback. Appreciate listening to me on Stitcher Radio. I think you're the first person I've heard that has sent me feedback anyway, listening to me on Stitcher. And for all of you out there listening to me on Stitcher Smart Radio, hey, thanks for listening. And you too can send feedback by sending it to feedback at airlinepilotguide.com. Okay, to your question, Anchorage. Well, I used to fly into Anchorage quite often, and that was back in my Air Force days. And flying the C-141 Starlifter, we would fly to Anchorage quite often, especially the time of year when the winds weren't very strong coming back from the Far East. We'd have to fly to Anchorage to refuel, and usually by the end of that flight, it was, you know, time for crew rest. So usually dropping into Anchorage meant spending the night. And that whole area, Anchorage, Alaska, is just beautiful. And the airport, from what I remember, it's been a long time since I've been out of the Air Force. Let's see, the last flight in the C-141 was back in 1985, probably well before you were born. And from what I remember, it was a great airport. I don't really remember too many specifics about it. And being hectic and close to Lake Hood, honestly, I don't remember, you know, any traffic conflicts or anything else. So I wish I could give you some kind of a harrowing story and near miss and all that kind of stuff, but I can't think of anything. So I just remember that Anchorage itself was a beautiful place and the airport was a first-class facility. Let's see, the only thing I can remember about, maybe it was when I was up in Fairbanks. We had a crew rest up there, and it was that time of year where the sun never went below the horizon. So I guess when would that be? The summertime? So it never really got dark, and I thought that was kind of weird because you're just so far north on the globe that during the summertime, because of the way the Earth is tilted toward the sun, you know, it just never got dark. I thought that was kind of weird. But that was Fairbanks, not Anchorage. So thanks for your feedback, Andy. And keep listening and keep sending more of that feedback. Now, we were just talking about Alaska, Anchorage, Alaska, military flying. And that would lead well into some feedback that I received. Here we go. From Jason. And he said that, you know what? I think I have some audio feedback from Jason. So let me go over here and come on, cooperate with me. Here we go. Let's listen to Jason's audio feedback.
Hi, Captain Jeff. Jason Rudd from Birmingham, Alabama, once again. On Airline Pilot Guide number 43, you played a great recording of a missed approach by Air Force One at the Toledo Airport. I really enjoyed getting to listen to that textbook demonstration of radio communication between the tower and Air Force One. That was really a treat to hear. My question, though, goes back to this. Who controls military aircraft when they're in United States airspace? I'm sure that military aircraft follow the instructions of the local tower controllers when they're coming and going from a civilian airport, but what about when military aircraft are on exercises or operations or just transiting the country from place to place? Do they follow civilian air traffic control? Do they have their own controllers? How are military traffic and civilian traffic kept separated? Just curious, and I would appreciate your feedback. Thanks again. Keep up the great work. God bless.
Well, most of the time, Jason, thanks for your feedback, by the way. Most of the time, the military and the civilian population of airplanes, air traffic, is all together. And so when you would fly in the military, as I did, and you were flying from, let's say, Travis Air Force Base to Honolulu, Hawaii, we'd be talking to Oakland Center and what's the center that we would talk to going into Hawaii? Would that be Honolulu? I don't remember. Anyway, we use all the civilian controlling agencies. The only time that you are controlled exclusively by military controllers is when you're going into an Air Force base, and then usually they have their own approach control, tower, ground facilities, all that kind of stuff is all manned by military people. And in fact, there are some places where, like if you go into Charleston, even if you're flying a civilian flight, you're being controlled by military air traffic control. Several places like that around the United States. So, when we mix together and we're flying to the same places or flying in the same airspace, we're being controlled by the same people and following the same rules. Another exception is when we're doing formation flying and we're doing, in-flight refueling. I guess that's the other one I was trying to think of. And in that case, when you have a couple airplanes very close to each other, it's kind of difficult for the civilian air traffic control system to kind of keep track of everybody, especially when they're really, really close. And in that case, we do something we call MARSA. I say I used to. MARSA is an acronym, and that stands for Military Assumes Responsibility for Separation of Aircraft. So MARSA. And basically, that's just when we're in close proximity and we need close coordination, we accept the responsibility to maintain our own separation. And then once we have concluded the formation flight or the in-flight refueling procedure, then we go back to air traffic control, the normal civilian air traffic control system, and the normal ATC procedures resume. So that is the answer to your question about military and civilian flying. That just reminded me of something. In fact, I was talking with my present first officer yesterday about this because we were kind of commenting on how tedious it is sometimes to have to use ramp control and these other controlling agencies to get clearances to do things. And he said, hey, did you ever do any of those exercises where you were completely silent? And I do remember a couple of times we'd probably practice this like once a year. You'd be at an airport. In this case, we were doing one of these exercises. I think it was called Cold Winter or I don't know, something like that. And we were up at Goose Bay in the province of Labrador in Canada. And we would have a mission that would require us to not use voice communications. So we would wait for light signals. So when we see a certain light signal from the tower, that would mean that we were cleared to taxi out to the airport, to the runway. And then we get another light signal. That means it's, you know, you're cleared for takeoff. And the whole darn flight, I think we went from Labrador, Canada, to over the North Atlantic. And I think we finally talked to somebody when we were getting into Scottish airspace, if I remember correctly. Anyway, pretty interesting exercise. But to answer your question again, Jason, if we're flying in the same airspace, we're using the same controlling agencies. Now, sometimes we actually use a different frequency. You general aviation pilots out there, you may have heard this. They'll be talking to a military airplane, and they'll say, switch to frequency 124.5 or 345.2. The second number, that the higher numbers, is a UHF frequency. So a lot of military airplanes have both, well, either only UHF frequencies, or they have both VHF and UHF frequency ranges and radios that will handle both of those frequency ranges. So you might hear that kind of thing when you're flying around. But again, we're being controlled by the same agencies normally. Okay, let's see here. Somebody sent me in some information about anti-laser eyewear. It was Chris. Chris says, we all know that household laser pointers have been used to distract and injure commercial and military pilots. Now, the Ministry of Defense in the UK is working on developing laser-proof glasses for that very reason. And this is the Defense Science and Technology Laboratory has been working with the Defense Equipment and Support to evaluate and assess the specially designed spectacles. The laser eye protection glasses can filter out different wavelengths of light from the spectrum, including those used in various laser weapons and laser pens, which are becoming increasingly available from the internet. Unlike conventional LEP, which tends to filter out and block just one wavelength from the color spectrum, the prototype spectacles made by Glasgow-based company Thin Film Solutions can filter out a range of different laser wavelengths, allowing greater operational benefits and flexibility for pilots. So that's cool. Now, if they could only come up with some kind of glasses that allows us to see wake turbulence from the airplane preceding us and turbulence in general. I know that there's going to be a day when we're going to be able to put on special goggles or glasses and we'll be able to see all that. That'll be nice. All right. Received this from Brad Charrington. Hey, Captain Jeff. It's your friend, Brad Charrington, here. I hope all is well with you and all the listeners out there. I am now working with an airline and guest service here in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I love being in the industry, and it gives me a great opportunity to network with pilots and learn new stuff about aviation. Anyway, I was browsing on YouTube and watching videos of your aircraft, the MD-88/90. I came across a video, and it is a person videotaping their boarding all the way to takeoff and climb out. Funny thing is, the captain makes an announcement at about 7.5 minutes into the video, and it's you, or at least it sounds like you. Thought this might be kind of funny to play, if you wish. I also had a question about in-flight announcements. Well, before I do that, before I continue with that part of your email, Chris, let me go over... I'm sorry, Brad. I've just said Chris because so many people send me feedback and so many people are named Chris, but no, this is Brad. Sorry, Brad. Okay, let's go over here, and I recorded a little clip of this YouTube video, and here's the captain making his announcement on the ground before the flight pushes back from the gate.
We're aboard just under an hour, and we're 57 minutes from takeoff to touchdown. And right now, beautiful day down there on the Gulf Coast. Sunny skies, temperature 46 degrees, and winds are light. Once we're on our way today, we'll get back with you and give you more details about the flight, the route, the estimated time of arrival, the updated weather conditions. In the meantime, we invite you to get all settled in, sit back, and relax. Should be pushing back here in about 10 minutes or so. Once again, great to have you aboard with us today. Flight 750, service to Gulfport, Biloxi.
How rude. Did you hear that lady talking the whole time I was talking on the public announcement there? Man. I get no respect. That is kind of weird, I have to tell you, hearing my own voice like that on a recording that somebody made. But yep, that was me. Absolutely, that's the format I use for my announcements. Okay, so continuing with Brad's email, would the pilot in command make most of the announcements, or would the second in command pilot handle those announcements? If you could talk about making announcements to your passengers, that would be interesting, as it is an important part of your job when it comes to keeping the passengers informed and comfortable. And then he gave me the links, part one and part two of flight 750 from Atlanta to Gulfport, Mississippi. And he closes by saying, that's about it for now. Hope you are doing well and happy flying. If you're ever in the Calgary airport, I'd love to meet for coffee and talk aviation. Yours truly, Brad. And I would love that too. In fact, I used to fly into Calgary and Edmonton quite often back in the old 727 days. But it's been quite some time since I've made it up into the beautiful Canadian province of Alberta. Let's see. So pilot in command. Okay, so the primary responsibility for making announcements is the captain, but the captain can designate or relegate that responsibility to another crew member. Now, the way it worked in three pilot crews was that the second officer was usually the one who would make the in-flight announcements, which was great for me because when I was a second officer, I loved to, you know, I'm doing a podcast, so I love making announcements. The way it works now in a two-pilot airplane, usually if it's, you know, we alternate flying. So if I start off the trip by flying the first flight from Atlanta to Memphis, the second officer, or the second in command, it's his responsibility, basically, the way it traditionally works at my airline, to make the in-flight announcements. Now, you know me, I like talking. And so I kind of gauge whether or not the first officer really wants to make any kind of announcement. And trust me, I'd say 90% of the time, most of the guys and girls I fly with, they don't like talking on the PA system. So I will say, oh, if you don't mind, or if you don't want to do it, I'd be happy to, because I really like, I'm one of those weirdos that likes talking. And usually that's it, and then I'll make all the PAs, whether it's my leg or their leg. If it's somebody who's good at making PAs and enjoys it, then yeah, when it's my leg, they do all that stuff. Now, the stuff on the ground, I usually do. Again, because it's not required of me, it's just that I enjoy doing it. But in all cases, it is the pilot command's responsibility and obligation to make announcements. But as I said, in practice, usually that is relegated or delegated to the first officer when he's not flying or she's not flying. I hope that's clear. If that's not, send me more feedback and I'll clarify. So that is that. And did you like the way I did that? We were talking about Labrador, one of the Canadian maritime provinces. I think it's a maritime province. Anyway, it's one of those way in the east, northeast of Canada when I was in the military, flying a lot of exercises out of there. And then I went to my Canadian listener, or one of my Canadian listeners, Brad Charrington. So thanks again, Brad, for your feedback. And keep it coming. You know what? I'm going to keep it in Canada. How about that? This is from Amar, and he, I believe, is living in the Toronto area. And he sent me a link. Well, first of all, let me read his feedback. I've been waiting to send you feedback for some time now. I found this story to be interesting. Cheers, Amar. And then he sent me this link to this article. And let me read a little bit of this. It was almost the end of a long, uneventful Pacific crossing for the 270 passengers aboard Air Canada Flight 33 to Sydney when an electrifying announcement came on the public address system. Vancouver folk singer and Juno Award-nominated Jill Barber, who was aboard the plane, expected a pre-landing announcement. Instead, she said she heard the captain say, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have received a call from search and rescue teams in Australia saying that there was a yacht that was sinking off the shore of Sydney. We're the closest aircraft in the vicinity, and they've asked us to identify the location and the boat. It's going to mean a slight detour. Thanks to extra fuel left on their plane and a pair of binoculars from a passenger, the crew of the Air Canada jetliner was credited with assisting in the rescue Monday of an Australian yacht adrift in the South Pacific." So basically, it was a happy ending. The 777 crew was able to spot the yacht, and then I think later an Air New Zealand Airbus 320 en route from or to Sydney from Auckland was also diverted to the area, and then later an Australian Dornier rescue plane arrived and dropped a life raft and a satellite phone to the solo yachtsman, who had, I guess, his main mast had snapped and was running low on fuel and was drifting some 500 kilometers east of the east coast of Australia. So happy ending. He was rescued and all was good. I guess they arrived about 90 minutes late into Sydney, but the article says that most of that delay or tardiness was due to having to deviate around some weather earlier in the flight, and not only because of the rescue assistance. So now, how do I feel about that? That would be a tough one. I mean, I'd certainly think, I laud that crew for doing that, because when somebody's in distress, you just have to, you know, you have to make the tough decision and try to help save lives. I guarantee you, though, here's the problem. I'm sure that at least one person on that flight has probably filed a lawsuit to sue for, you know, having to go out of their way, putting them in jeopardy, jeopardizing their safety, etc., to try to help with this rescue of this yachtsman. Am I wrong? Prove it. I hope that I'm wrong. But I think I know humanity, and I'm afraid that that's probably going to happen. But I applaud the crew for taking the time and doing the right thing. So thanks, Amar, for your feedback, and keep it coming. All right, you know how I love drones. Well, and actually, I don't hate drones, I really don't. I think there is a place for unmanned or autonomous aircraft. I just don't think it's with all the other airplanes out there with pilots and passengers on airplanes. But I was reading through my news articles and saw that there was a successful test by the by DARPA. They did an autonomous high altitude refueling test, and I believe the airplanes were at 44,000 feet, which is about 13,400 meters, and they, I guess, had a 60% success rate, and they were only expecting about a 17% success rate, and one drone was up there trailing a drogue chute for in-flight refueling. No actual transfer of fuel was made. It was just kind of a concept test, and there's a refueling probe on the other unmanned drone, and as I said, they were successful 60% of the time to actually get a connection of the two drones. So that means that, I guess theoretically, you could have drones up there flying for, you know, a long, long time, if not forever. So I thought that was kind of an interesting story. And speaking of interesting stories, how about taking a beautiful airplane, one of my favorites, the Boeing 727, and equipping it with some auto flight systems, remote auto flight systems, three crew members flying it into position, and then bailing out the aft air stair door, and the chase airplane taking control of the airplane and crashing it into the Mexican desert. Yeah, it was the Discovery Channel. They have a new show called Curiosity, and I think this is their first episode. I'm not sure, but it was very interesting. I didn't see it live on TV, but I was able to watch it on the internet, and it was very, very interesting. And one of the things that was interesting to me, I guess they were doing some testing to see how the flight test dummies inside the airplane would respond to crashes and who would sustain the most injuries based on the part of the airplane that they were riding in. And I think a lot of this is kind of a moot point, really, because it depends on how the airplane actually crashes. I mean, if it crashes exactly the way that this 727 did, then you can say, okay, well, the people sitting near the wing and in the tail would be the ones that come out the best, and the ones sitting up near the front would not fare so well, especially the pilots. If you watch this show, or if you watch this link that I'll have in my show notes, you'll see that the cockpit section of the 727 kind of snapped off and kind of rolled underneath the main fuselage, and would not be a happy ending for those pilots. Let's see, what else was I going to say about this? Oh, I remember years ago when I was flying the 727, as we were deplaning passengers in Phoenix, Arizona, a gentleman came up to me and said, "Hey, I just wanted to introduce myself. I was one of the engineers for this airplane, the 727. And he said that this was Boeing's first attempt at making, producing, building an airplane that had tail-mounted engines and a T-tail. And they weren't sure exactly how beefy to build this thing. So he said that they basically made it three times as tough as they really needed to. Again, because they didn't really have experience with this type of structure. And he said that that thing was triple engineered for durability, etc. Now, if you watch the show, or if you watch this video on the internet, you'll see that that tail section, when that thing crashes down at 1,500, 2,000 feet per minute, whatever it was, when it impacted the desert floor, that tail with the engines mounted in the back was like nothing. It was just like a regular landing. It stayed completely intact. And I think if you look at most crashes of the 727, that T-tail and structure in the back of the airplane was almost always intact. So that just reminded me of that little exchange that I had with the Boeing engineer regarding the 727. So anyway, check out the thing. I think that some scientific data was gleaned from that crash, and hopefully it will help with future safety implications. Okay, here we go. Feedback from Ben Evans from Columbus, Ohio. You know what? Before I read your feedback, Ben, I'm going to read Peter Doyle's, because he sent me some feedback that I should have read last week, and I didn't, because, well, you heard the excuse that I had at the beginning of the show. So here we go. "Hey, Captain Jeff, thanks so much for your explanation on British Airways Flight 9. Despite having read the Wikipedia article quite a few times, you have a way of reading it and explaining it so well that it felt like I'd never read it before. Keep it up. Thanks. Now, for some feedback. Firstly, to your listener who wanted some feedback if you should make a blog podcast of his traveling, the answer is most certainly yes. Next." Okay, so you have a vote, a positive vote to start your own blog / podcast about traveling as a passenger. Okay. "Next, I was just on a flight from JFK to Manchester. Excuse me. And at about 60 minutes out of Manchester, the flight attendant came on the PA and asked if there was a medical professional on board, as there was a poorly passenger. About 10 minutes later, the captain comes on the PA and announces, "Due to the unwell passenger, we have declared an emergency and will be landing in Manchester in 30 minutes. A few questions came to my mind right away. At that point in time, we were still flying over Ireland. Between us and Manchester, there were at least three or four airports closer that I should count off the top of my head. So if this was indeed an emergency, why did we continue to Manchester instead of landing at a closer airstrip? 2. When does a captain decide to divert, and when did they decide to continue? 3. When an airliner has to make an emergency landing due to a medical situation, who pays for the extra landing fees, fuel, etc.? 4. If we were 60 minutes out, how was the captain able to cover that distance in half the amount of time? I would be most grateful if you could answer any or all of the questions. As always, keep up the good work, and wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility and tailwinds, Peter." Good questions, Peter. And some of those are questions in my mind as well, especially how he made up the 60 minutes and cut it in half to 30. That's quite a trick, isn't it? I think that the only thing that I can say regarding that is that perhaps that when they got lower, in most cases, when we get below 10,000 feet, they want us to slow to 250 knots, that they continued to keep their speed up or higher to get in faster. It also may have something to do with the fact that when you declare a medical emergency or any type of emergency, you are given priority handling. And because of that, you don't have to slow down, get sequenced into the flow of traffic, etc. And in this case, you're basically cleared directly to whatever airport you want to divert to or continue to. So that's one way to shave off some time, that's for sure. Your first question was, at that point of time, we were still flying over Ireland, and he can think of at least three or four airports closer to Manchester. So why did they continue to Manchester? Well, I can tell you, because I've had this experience myself. We were flying from Atlanta to, I think, Bradley International in Connecticut, outside of Hartford, between Hartford, Connecticut, and Springfield, Massachusetts. And just about the time we were flying over Long Island, we got and I always monitor the PA system. So when the flight attendants are making announcements, I hear what they're saying to you, the passenger. And the first thing I heard was a flight attendant making an announcement over the PA saying, are there any medical professionals, any doctors, any nurses on board? And I thought, uh-oh, we got something going on back here. And then a few minutes later, the head flight attendant came on. She said they had a passenger back in the back who was having some kind of a medical problem. And so I look down and I see John F. Kennedy International Airport on Long Island over there. But I'm at like 30,000 feet. And in front of me, and I'm about on the normal descent path that you would be on going into Bradley. And so I made the decision at that point that I was going to continue on to Bradley International Airport instead of diverting and going directly to John F. Kennedy International. Again, because I had a lot of altitude to lose, and so I was going to, that would take time and distance to lose, and that's one thing. So maybe I could have landed 5 to 10 minutes earlier at that point, but once you get on the ground, then you have to deal with all the traffic at John F. Kennedy, whereas I'm going to Bradley International, a much smaller airport, and less ground traffic to deal with once we're on the airport property. Number two, I have all these other passengers, another 149, 150 passengers as well, who are going to be greatly inconvenienced if I go to an airport that they were not planning on going to. So I have that going on in the back of my head. Third point I want to make is that anytime we have a medical situation like this, we don't rely on our own judgment as far as the medical severity of the distress of the passenger. We call an outside agency who is specifically trained to deal with all kinds of passenger ailments in flight. And then once we give the vitals and other symptoms that a passenger is experiencing, then they tell us what their recommendation is. Now, of course, as the captain, I can always override anybody's advice or recommendations as long as I have a good reason to do it and I'm prepared to explain myself in front of the chief pilot and whoever else has questions about my decision. So I usually defer to medical professionals in this case, and the folks that we deal with basically recommended that we continue to Bradley. And at that point, actually, I'd already made that decision, so it was kind of a moot point. So in this case, the airline, British Airways, I'm sure they probably have the same type of system where they rely upon medical professionals consulting with them to determine how critical the situation is and if it's something that requires landing short of the primary destination. So, you know, we're juggling all these things. Yes, we are concerned about the welfare of a passenger, but we are also concerned about the welfare of all the passengers, so we have to take that into account. Okay, and when an airliner has to make an emergency landing due to a medical situation, who pays for the extra landing fees, fuel, etc.? Now, you know, I haven't ever considered this question, Peter. I believe, but I'm not sure, that the airline would just basically suck that up. They would have to pay for it, just in, as in any kind of an emergency situation. I'm not sure. I'm not positive about that, but I'm 90% sure that that's just one of those things that the airline pays for in this, the cost of doing business. I think that maybe when you have situations where you have to divert to somewhere because of mischief, misbehavior, that type of thing, where the airline can go after that person and try to get, you know, have them share the liability of the costs involved in doing the divert. But when it's somebody who is sick, unless there was some kind of negligence there, I doubt that they would be required to pay for any of the costs of the divert. So that is my answer. It's not definitive, but I think it's pretty accurate. And thanks again, Peter, for sending in the feedback, and I'm sorry that I missed it last week. All right, another piece of feedback, this time, and this show is almost exclusively feedback, so because I'm trying to clear out the backlog, and you people are not listening to me. I said, don't send me any more feedback because these shows are going long. Let's see, I'm looking down, and oh, I've only been going 46 minutes. That's not bad. Okay, I don't feel so bad now. Now I'm going to take a sip of my Smoking Loon Old Vine Zinfandel 2010 from California. That's just for medicinal purposes, of course. Keep my throat nice and lubricated, you know. Okay. Greetings, Captain Jeff. This is John in Minneapolis again, the guy who asked about the Boeing 717. I just finished listening to Airline Pilot Guy episode number 43 while on an Acme MD-88 flight from El Paso to Atlanta. Great timing on the episode, by the way. The episode finished just as the captain did the double ding thing with the no smoking sign to tell the flight attendants that we had descended to flight level 100 and it was time to turn off electronic devices. Well, thank you. I pride myself in my timing, John. Okay, after we landed at ATL on runway 2810, sorry, I didn't note which end we approached from. I noticed as we were taxiing along taxiway Sierra Gulf that there were odd pseudo hold lines painted across the taxiway with a yellow sign that said B747-8. Are these alternate hold lines for runway crossings if the aircraft doing the taxiing is a Boeing 747-8 due to their size? Okay, here's your answer. Yes, that's actually something pretty new. Boeing just released not too long ago the Dash 8 version of the 747, and due to its increased wingspan, there are new markings on the airport. And the one that you're talking about there, I think, is a hold line that an aircraft like mine would hold short of if there was a 747-8 taxiing along the perpendicular taxiway, because the wing tips would be, you know, close to that line, that hold short line. There may be, and I have seen some other 747-8 signs and hold lines other places, and that may be for them as well. But actually, I think it's more for, as I said, the other airplanes to hold short, just to give the 747-8 more clearance for their increased wing size. So yes, that is why you see those. And another question. I'm sitting in the food court in Terminal A, right over the tunnel that the ground service vehicles use to pass between the two sides of Terminal A and the terminal across the ramp. Terminal B? Yes. Well, on one side, Terminal B, and on the other side, actually, if you're sitting in the food court in Terminal A, you're actually looking at what they call the T terminal in Atlanta for the terminal. Yeah. So you're in A, you're looking across there, that's Terminal T. If you were sitting on the other side, say at Chili's restaurant, then you would be looking at Terminal B. It looks like utter chaos out there. Have you ever had a ground service vehicle zip in front of your aircraft while you're taxiing on the ramp? Yes. Is there some sort of unofficial signal or etiquette? that pilots and ground service vehicle drivers use to avoid getting in each other's way? Yes. Let me tell you. The general rule is that when you're in an airplane and you're moving or are about to move, you turn your taxi light on. That is normally the indication to other airplanes and ground vehicles that the airplane is moving or is about to start moving. So when we're crossing all these vehicle roadways on the airport aprons, and they see an airplane rolling along the ramp, and they see my taxi light on, they're supposed to gauge my speed and decide whether or not there is going to be time for them to cross in front of me or not. And yes, there have been some close calls. A lot of times people are out there, in a hurry, trying to get from point A to point B, get your luggage to the airplane quickly, et cetera. And they misjudge the speed, the taxiing speed of an airplane. They kind of misjudge where the airplane's going, because when we're on a parallel taxiway to to the ramps, sometimes they assume, based on our speed, that we're not going to be turning into that ramp. Of course, they don't know me. I like to taxi kind of fast. In fact, look at that YouTube video, part two, that was talked about earlier in the podcast, and you'll see me taxiing in to the gate in Gulfport. And, you know, I want you to get to that gate as quickly as possible, right? So I tend to taxi more like a Southwest Airlines pilot, a little bit on the quick side. But I have to be careful, because I have to keep in mind that there are other vehicles out there and that kind of thing. So, and this is an aside. I'm sorry to interrupt your feedback, John, but the previous feedback with the with me doing the announcement, the Gulfport flight, etc., the part two of two is the actual takeoff roll and the initial climb out, actually all the way to landing in Gulfport. And I don't recall if that was my landing or my first officer's landing. But the interesting thing is he was positioned just in front of the right engine in the back of the airplane, which gave him a great view of the right wing of the MD-88. And you can see the flaps, and you can see the ailerons, and you can see the spoiler panels when they pop up on landing. And, I've talked about this many times, that the MD-88 and MD-90 ailerons are controlled by cables that control a control tab. And if you look at the video, you'll see on the trailing edge of the aileron, which is not the flap. The flap is the closest thing to the wing, about, I don't know how many feet out, maybe 20 feet out or so, is the aileron. And at the trailing edge of the aileron, you'll see a couple tabs. The one is the closest to the airplane is the control tab, and the one a little bit farther out toward the wingtip is the trim tab. And if you look closely, you can actually see that moving, which ends up in turn moving the aileron, which in turn actually makes the wing bank and roll. And on landing, the spoiler panels pop up after the airplane touches down. That's an automatic system that we have. And that is there to spoil the lift on the wings so that all the weight of the airplane is on the landing gear, and the brakes have much better stopping capability. Okay, so back to this email regarding the taxiing and the signals that we give to ground vehicles. And yes, we use our taxi light on, that means we're moving. Taxi light off, that means we're not moving. Unless, of course, we forget to turn our taxi light on or off. But that's the way it's supposed to work anyway. As always, you do a great podcast. Thanks. As the listener in North Carolina commented, we don't mind the longer episodes at all. Oh, thanks. Wishing you tailwinds, clear skies, and no air traffic or ground congestion. Thanks, John. And he is a consulting engineer from Commvault. Okay. Let's see here. I think I've already read that. This is from David Moulineau in London. I think David has sent me feedback in the past, because I remember trying to pronounce his last name. Have I? You'll pardon me if I've already read this, because I have a feeling that I did, but just in case I haven't. No. David, I think, was the one that had the survey, right? I don't remember now. My brain is going. My wife says to me all the time, Jeff, a mind is a terrible thing to lose. I'm not sure I understand why she says that to me all the time. But okay, my name is David. And I live about 5 miles from London Heathrow, England. Have you ever flown here? No, I haven't. Can you believe that? All the international flying I've done, I've never flown into England. But I hope to someday, because I have a lot of friends out there, like you, David, who I'd love to visit sometime. Okay, I found your podcast incredibly interesting and enlightening. I've worked designing and making avionic flight instrumentation and flight control software for various aircraft types over the years. I have a particular interest in HCI, which stands for Human-Computer Interface, within the cockpit. There have been many years of research and study into this area, and several air accidents have established poor instrumentation or confusing user interfaces as a significant contributory factor to the accident. I'm interested in your experiences. Have you ever had to use any cockpit instrumentation or flight management computer, glass cockpit or not, which have struck you as annoying, counterintuitive, or distracting to use? Anything where you could help me as a flight software designer, appreciate better the frustrations you pilot chaps experience. Thanks in advance, David. Now, I wrote David back and said, I can't think of anything offhand, at least when I wrote him my reply in the email. And just now, I was thinking one of the things that's a little bit frustrating, distracting, and it really is not a flight instrument system. It's the ACARS system, that digital interface that we use to communicate. It has a keypad on it, and it's a touch screen pad. And it's, I'm used to on my iPhone, on my computer, all the keyboards that I use. I'm used to the QWERTY keyboard layout, you know, the QWERTYUIOP across the first row, etc. And so you're kind of used to that layout. Well, this system in the ACARS is laid out in alphabetical order. So when you're typing a message and you're pushing A, B, you know, whatever, you have to, I have to really think about where all these letters are. I'm not thinking, you know, chronological or alphabetical, or I guess chronological is not right, alphabetical order. I'm thinking of the QWERTY keyboard, and so I'm always kind of looking in the wrong place. So that's one of my frustrations, but that's a system I think that is being phased out. So I think perhaps in some of the more modern airplanes, they have more of the QWERTY keyboard layout. Most of the airplanes I've flown are the older instrumentation, including the airplane I fly now. I mean, we do have some glass, but it's not very fancy stuff. And I can't think of anything that's glaring offhand that is counterintuitive or distracting to use. Now, you know, I've talked about this many times, the Airbus philosophy of their flight control system, and one of the major problems that I have with the Airbus automation philosophy is the fact that the control devices, you know, the side stick controller, the throttles, where you basically put the throttles up to a detent and they stay fixed, even though the engines are spooling up and spooling back and, you know, changing thrust settings and everything else, and the throttles are just staying in the same place. The side stick controller doesn't really have any feedback to the pilot actually, you know, actuating the side stick controller. And as we know, in Air France 447 over the Atlantic Ocean, the two other pilots who were in the cockpit as this thing was stalling from 38,000 feet all the way to the ocean floor had no idea. There may have been one point where there was some idea by the other first officer that the controlling pilot was holding that pilot joystick all the way full aft. But there was no, in other words, if this were a Boeing airplane, including the fly-by-wire 787 and 777. If you walked into the cockpit, you're falling out of the sky in the middle of the night, and you saw the yoke, the control yoke, all the way back in both pilots' laps, that captain who was interrupted from his crew rest, who came into the cockpit to figure out what was going on, would have seen the control yokes all the way back in the laps of the other two pilots and said, "What are you doing? We're stalling. Push forward. Recover from the stall." But in the case of Air France 447, sides to controller over there to the side, nobody knew. Okay, so that's a big problem as far as interface is concerned, I think. So that's the only thing I can think of offhand. Anybody out there who is listening to the show might have, if you have any ideas for David, a human-computer interface designer, engineer, I think it's very important that we speak up and let him know, you know, how we feel about this whole situation. If there's anything that's kind of weird or counterintuitive or frustrating for you or annoying, please send me feedback, feedback@airlinepilotguy.com, and I'll send it over to David in London, England. Thank you, David. I appreciate your concern in this. It's really important. I think that has the potential to save many, many lives in the future. Steve in Kansas City sent me some feedback. I hope a controller chimes in on the low altitude alerts for Air Force One at Toledo, which you featured on Airline Pilot Guy number 43. But if not, here is my take. Number one, the FAAO 7110.65, the controller's Bible, calls for controllers to issue low altitude alerts when an aircraft is, in the controller's judgment, in unsafe proximity to terrain obstructions. There is no caveat that says, never issue alerts when the aircraft is established on a published instrument approach procedure. Good point. The RNAV GPS approach may have been flown in a step-down fashion to try to break out of the overcast. The controller may not have been accustomed to this since there is an ILS for that runway. That's another good point. Number three, Mode C altitude indications are considered valid by ATC if they're within 300 feet of pilot-reported altitude. Air Force One could have been over Rios intersection at precisely 1,280 feet, but the towers displayed may have indicated as much as 300 feet lower. Okay, another good point. And finally, radar facilities, and maybe tower cabs, have an automated low-altitude alert system. If the LAAS was beeping in the tower cab and there's a Secret Service agent standing behind you, you best believe that I'm issuing the warning to the pilot. A very, very good point. So that could actually have been the case. You know, you getting that low altitude alert system going off and you're responsible for guiding and controlling Air Force One with the President of the United States on board. Probably a good idea to say something. He concludes, Air Force One landed safely and it's a non-issue. If there had been any problem, this poor controller would have been called before Congress and asked why he didn't issue a low-altitude alert. Think of it like Pascal's wager applied to the air traffic control world. But maybe that's a topic for the Catholic pilot. And he ends with peace, Steve. You're right, Steve. Maybe Pascal's wager may not be the appropriate thing to talk about. If you're interested in Blaise Pascal, the brilliant mathematician, you might want to look up in Google Pascal's wager to see what Steve is talking about there. So very good feedback. Thanks, Steve. And you know what, everybody, all of your feedback is great, and I appreciate it. Let's see. From Mark Labrowski, he sent me this link that talks about our acting interim administrator, Michael Huerta, says he wants certification, aircraft certification, the time and the cost to cut it in half while increasing safety. So apparently, manufacturers have to spend lots of money and it takes a lot of time to get things certified so that they can be approved for sale and production and eventual use by airlines and consumers, and he is proposing some streamlined procedures to cut the certification time in half. So that's good. That's awesome, actually. Israel imposes new transponder rules after UAV incursion. Did you see this? There was some great video of an Israeli aircraft, I think it was an F-16, shooting down an unmanned drone coming into its airspace. And I think that was launched by Hezbollah, and at least they're taking responsibility for it. And Israel is introducing new regulations to make the use of transponder mandatory for operators of ultralights and other general aviation aircraft following the 6th of October airspace incursion involving an unmanned air vehicle believed to have been flown from Lebanon. New rules will demand the use of a transponder on every aerial platform that flies into Israeli airspace, and for operators to be able to maintain constant radio contact with the Israeli Air Force's control centers, which create a complete picture of traffic movements. Other regulations are already in place for hang gliders in areas near the nation's borders. So you could understand the sensitivity that this country has to airplanes flying into its airspace that are not identified. Okay, I'm going through my list here. I don't want to make the same mistake I made last time by skipping over somebody's very important feedback. Oh, I had this exchange with Kappa or Copa. Again, I'm not sure exactly how he pronounces his first name. And I think he was doing this just to provoke me. You know, I talked about the jackscrew nut on the Alaskan Air MD-80 flight, MD-83, I believe, that crashed just off the California coastline because the threads of the Acme nut were stripped due to improper maintenance procedures. And he wrote this to me. He says, "How do you feel about flying a plane that's basically unsafe? I'm thinking about the T-tail and its jackscrew. If it fails, there's basically nothing else for pilots, crew, and passengers to do than to kiss their donkey goodbye and hope the impact is swift and decisive." And I responded by saying, well, I mean, there are a lot of systems and mechanical failures, crashes in the past that, you know, weren't covered by redundant systems. And that kind of got me thinking about safety in general. And I wanted to do really a whole episode about safety, and maybe I'll do that in the future. But, you know, I'm a safety investigator. I went through a safety school. I was a wing safety officer in the Air Force. And so safety is important to me. Well, it's important to all people who fly. Well, probably important to anybody who does anything that has the least amount of risk involved, including driving your car on the highway, right? I mean, that's technically and statistically more unsafe than going flying in an airplane, right? I think I remember something way back in my training that talks about the term and the philosophy behind safety, and it's basically balancing risk and benefit. Right? If you want to be completely safe, then don't leave your house. And even then, there might be something unsafe about staying in your house. But, I mean, really, if you don't want to be in a car accident, don't get into a car. If you don't want to be in an airplane crash, don't fly an airplane. Am I exposed to more risk by basically flying as a career? Well, yeah, of course. Statistically speaking, I'm in that airplane a lot more than you are, right? But you have to kind of use some logic and rationale here. Safety is that balance between the risk involved and the benefit for taking that risk. And I think the statistics will prove this, that we have it right. I mean, look at the statistics as far as fatal airplane crashes in the United States in the last 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. I don't think it's ever been lower. And that's because over time, we keep improving mechanical systems on airplanes and human mechanical interfaces, controlling situations, etc. Is it perfectly safe, 100%? No, it's not. But it's awfully darn close to 100% safe. I think that we live in this time now where the safety is at an all-time high, and training of pilots and the interface between the machine and man or woman is the most important thing to focus on. So I am looking forward to talking a little bit more about safety, and I invite your feedback regarding that. It's going to be one of those long episodes again, I guess. This is from, heck, I didn't write down the person's name. Well, anyway, this is from somebody who is a happy employee of Acme Express, and I'm sorry, who wrote this to me, and I didn't write your name down. I'm sorry. Hey, Captain Jeff. First of all, I'd like to say great job on the podcast. I listen all the time in the car or at work, and you never fail to keep me informed, entertained via pertinent and often humorous news stories and anecdotes from all over the aviation community. I'm writing today to ask a veteran of the industry how incredible the bygone era that most refer to as the golden age of aviation really was. The reason I ask this is because I've been an A&P, an airframe and power plant mechanic, for a large regional carrier for the past 5 years or so, and to be honest, I couldn't be happier, unless I was the guy sitting in the left seat of one of these jets. It seems, however, that regardless of how appreciative I am of my job, most of the people around me are constantly complaining of low wages, expensive benefits, and an awful work schedule. To play devil's advocate for a moment, yes, the work schedule is almost unbearable for even myself, a single 30-year-old with no wife or kids. So I imagine trying to balance a family and a rough work schedule could be problematic. On the other hand, I feel like I'm compensated very fairly for my efforts, and the high cost of benefits is not exclusive to our industry, nor is the danger of the outsourcing of jobs and possibility of furloughs or lower layoffs. If you were to ask many of the people I work with how things were as recently as the late 90s, they will tell a tale of six-figure pay scales, free benefits, and easy travel. Standby these days is a joke. I typically buy my tickets even though I fly free on most of the legacy carriers. And phenomenal work schedules. While I can't imagine scheduling has changed very much, I believe that most of what they say is true regarding pay and benefits. But is it possible that they were compensated so well at their former company that the company could simply not afford to stay afloat? Given the option, I personally would choose longevity over higher pay right now. As far as the workload goes, we are given plenty of time to work scheduled maintenance and MEL items and are never asked to do anything that we feel could compromise safety aboard any of our flights. This means if we find a discrepancy that requires immediate grounding of the airplane, we are never questioned. We simply remove the airplane from service until we are satisfied that we have 100% airworthy airplane, and I have never seen a mechanic, including myself, decline to ride along on a test flight. So why does everybody seem so dissatisfied with their current position? I suppose is a point that I'm trying to drive at. Anyways, any feedback would be interesting to hear from somebody as seemingly knowledgeable as yourself on all things aviation. The key word there is seemingly. Also, if you have any tips on or for a full-time worker aspiring to at least get something back out of his flight training, please let me know. I'd like to finish up my commercial CFI and CFII ASAP and give some primary instruction, hopefully advance from there. Oh, and if possible, I try to maintain a certain level of discretion, so I ask that if you share my thoughts with the listeners of the Airline Pilot Guide podcast, please refrain from using my name. Oh, now I remember why I didn't write down who this was, because of that last sentence. There's a reason for it. Okay. So, to my anonymous feedback provider, thank you very much. A lot of good stuff here. I think that, and I think you sense it as well, that this is the kind of thing that no matter what kind of job people are doing out there, there are going to be people who are not happy, who want to complain. That's one of my pet peeves. I don't know. I mean, I try not to complain. I hope I haven't complained on this podcast. I really, really tire of people who complain about things. You know, I remember as a second officer and a first officer early on in my career, and this was back in the days when we were making really, really good money in the major airlines before bankruptcy and all these big cutbacks and pensions disappearing and everything else. And I remember flying with captains and first officers, but mostly captains from what I remember, who would complain about every single thing. They were just grumps. Nobody did anything right. Everything in their lives, come to find out, were bad. Their marriages, their children, the company, the CEO of the company out to get them. You know, really? And that's when I realized that there are a certain percentage of people in this world, and you listeners out there, you know what I'm talking about. You work with them. No matter how good it is, no matter how much money they're making, no matter what the benefits are, they're still not going to be happy because they are happy being miserable. Now, are things worse than they were in the golden days of aviation? Of course they are. I'm sure that there are some things that are better than they were back, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago. But, you know, pay, compensation obviously has not kept up. Benefits, you know, we bear the cost and burden of more and more of our health care, insurance, and all that kind of stuff. Yes. But I still think that there's going to be a certain percentage of people that are just not going to be happy. And I can't tell you how many times that I wanted to look at this person complaining and say, really? I mean, I wanted to click my shoes together and like make this person disappear and put him into a coal mine, into the hull of a ship in a shipyard. Some of these jobs that are just terrible. But people are out there doing them. And I thank God for people who are willing to go work in coal mines, people who are willing to go work on, you know, in shipyards, on oil rigs, who are out there doing the dirty work, hard work, who are away from their families and aren't compensated very well. And that's what they do. That's their life. And I'm so blessed that I get to do a job. I mean, I fly for a living, and sometimes I have to remind myself, people would pay to do what I do, and I get paid rather well for doing my job, and I really have to make sure that I never take that for granted. Yes, things could be better, and I think that our industry right now is really facing something important, and it's going to be very important in the next few years because we're facing that pilot shortage, which I've talked about before in previous podcasts. This pilot shortage is coming finally because a lot of us are getting close to that magic 65 years old. I'm not yet. I have another a little bit more than 11 years to go before that point. But there is going to be a crisis, not a crisis, but there's going to be a need for qualified pilots in the airline workforce here in the next 5, 10, 15 years. And a lot of people out there, even if they love flying, I mean, like Steve, he loves flying. He's got that beautiful Cessna Corvallis 400, and he gets to go up there and fly because he has the means to do it. But there are people out there who have that love of flying who would love to have a career in aviation, be an airline pilot, but they don't want to spend so much time away from their families. They don't want to, you know, endure some of the things that we have to endure do this job, and the compensation is just not enough for them, and they're going to do other things, which is good. But that means that the people who really have a passion for flying but want to be able to provide for their families in the future are going to say, you know what? You're not compensating me enough to be away from my family that much. Even though I love flying airplanes, I'll do something else. So I think that the industry is really going to have to bump up compensation, get it back to where it used to be or get close. You know, I don't think it'll ever be where it used to be back in the 60s and 70s, you know, corrected for inflation and all that. But you have to make it attractive, right? I mean, you hear this all the time from corporations. Well, we had to give this multi-million dollar benefit package to these upper-level employees. Why? Because we didn't want them to leave. We need them. We don't want them to leave. They're going to go work for somebody else who's going to pay them more, give them better benefits. Well, the same thing's going to happen. There's going to have to happen, in my opinion, in this industry. They're going to have to start paying people the skilled job that we have, the appropriate compensation. So those of you out there who are listening to this podcast right now, who have the desire to fly for a living, I think this is a good time to get in there. And I feel very, very positive about the future of this career field. And I think that if you're young and you have a passion for flying, now is the time to get into a career in aviation, especially flying. And this anonymous person who is an AMP mechanic, thank you very much for sending this feedback in, because it really, you know, kind of hit a nerve in me. And I agree with you. I think that, you know, we need to kind of get real when it comes to the way things are, our economy and everything else. And sure, that things could be better, but you have to look at the glass half full, not half empty. And I encourage you to keep up your work in finishing up your commercial CFI and CFII and getting into flight instruction and all that kind of stuff. Because, as I said, this is the time. You said you're a single 30-year-old. You're young. I know you don't feel like it, but I was 30 years old when I was hired by Acme 24 years ago, almost 24 years ago. And you got a long career ahead of you. So I highly encourage you to finish it up and start putting your resume, your applications in for airlines, because I think the future is good. So there we go. Now, from Singapore and Mr. Yong Lim Fu, you may have remembered his earlier feedback to me. I don't know, it was a few months ago. I was talking about getting into some of these aviation cadet programs. He's from Singapore, and I asked him to keep us apprised with, you know, how his journey is going in his pursuit of an aviation career. And he writes, "Hi, Captain Jeff. Once again, thank you for the podcast on aviation, as it keeps me going in my pursuits toward a career in aviation. Keep up the great job. Let me share more about myself. I'm Yong Lim Fu from Singapore. During mandatory service to the nation, I got into air grading as a military pilot trainee, but I did not pass the selection, and that was 10 years ago. Subsequently, I applied for the nation's youth flying club during my university days, but in vain, since our country's Air Force and the youth flying club are affiliated. Prior to my university, I managed to enroll into Imperial College London Aeronautical Engineering. However, I cannot attend the course since I do not have the means to finance the studies. Nearing to the end of my university graduation, I applied for Airline A cadet pilot, but I was once again turned down during my second interview. I was probably too nervous. With great determination, I've applied for Airline B cadet pilot. I have passed the final stage and cleared the medical stage when the new immigration rules kicked in. In essence, it will be difficult for international applicants to be enrolled into ab initio program. Well, that's my story, and I hope it's interesting to you. Yeah, it is. Meanwhile, I'm looking around and also refining my business to finance the further training. Currently, I'm in the midst of obtaining my private pilot's license in the Johor Flying Club located in Senai, Malaysia. Hence, may I know what's your kind advice to me so that I can proceed to get myself into an aviation career. You seem to have been through a lot in order to achieve where you are now. You are the person who can give great advice. Lastly, all the best to both of us in our endeavors. Regards, Yong Lim Fu. Well, honestly, Yong Lim, I really actually had it quite easy. As you know, I right out of college, I went into the Air Force, went through Air Force pilot training. After my short time in the Air Force, a little over 7 years, I got hired by a major airline in the United States. And from that point on, I've been living the life of an airline pilot. And, you know, things have been, you know, there's some bumps along the road, but I've been very fortunate in my timing. I've never been furloughed from my job. I've experienced stagnation, yes. Pay cuts, yes. But I've never, not a day without a job. And so I've, again, considered myself very blessed. And so much of this aviation world is timing. And perhaps you're one of those people that just timing is not good. And I think my advice for you is to keep on we need people like you who have a passion for flying and are not giving up. They're not going to let one person say, you don't have what it takes. You know, you just keep on pursuing as you're doing, and eventually, I know that this is going to pay off for you. So if any of you out there listening right now have any more advice for Yong Lim Fu, send it to me, and I'll read it. And we all need to encourage each other to get to where we want to go, especially if you have a passion for this, because that's the type of person we need in this industry. Okay. Another Chris from Boston again. It's amazing to me that you have so many listeners, feedback centers, with the name Chris. And that's your son's name, too. It's very ironic. Anyway, I just got back from our family vacation in Aruba this weekend and wanted to share an experience we had as well as ask a few questions. We were scheduled to return on Friday, the 12th of October, at 4:12 on AirTran Flight 1806. And then connect in Atlanta to continue to Boston later that night. We arrived at the Aruba Airport around 1 p.m. After checking in and going through security and U.S. Customs, we sat down at the gate, and I went to get the family a bite to eat. While I was waiting in line, a PA announcement stated that due to a fire department strike on the island, the airport had been closed. No flights were coming in or going out until further notice. I went back and alerted the family about the delay. Our main concern was not the delay in Aruba, but the possibility of missing our connection in Atlanta. To make a long story short, 3+ hours later, the Aruba authorities flew in some firefighters from the nearby island of Curaçao, and the airport reopened. Unfortunately, while the airport was closed, all Aruba-bound flights from the U.S. were diverted to San Juan, so we had to wait another couple of hours for our plane to get to Aruba. All in all, we didn't take off from Aruba until 7:16 p.m. We missed our connection in Atlanta, so we had to stay the night and proceed on to Boston on Saturday morning. I was surprised that when the flight landed in Aruba after getting diverted to San Juan, the crew remained aboard. They had left Atlanta at 11:15 and didn't arrive in Aruba until after 6. The same crew did, in fact, fly us back to Atlanta, arriving at 11:09 p.m. I know that the rules about crew rest are being adjusted soon, but I was curious what the current rules are in situations like this. Also, once we boarded the plane in Aruba, the captain came on the PA and alerted us that they were not able to push back because their filed flight plan had timed out. What is the normal time limit on a filed commercial flight plan? What a weekend experience and a way to end a vacation. We would have thought that the lovely island of Aruba would cause an entire set of flight delays. No, who would have thought that the lovely island of Aruba would cause an entire set of flight delays? The realities of air travel is that delays can happen and do happen everywhere. my kids and I enjoyed all the time at the airports, but I can't say the same for my wife. Talk soon. Thanks, Jeff. Keep up the good work, Chris. Okay. First question, the flying time. Now, the assumption here is that the crew that flew into Aruba after diverting to San Juan had not flown any flights prior to their flight from Atlanta, leaving at 11:15. So when they arrived back in Atlanta at 11:09, that was just under 12 hours of flying. And the crew duty day is different from the actual scheduled length of flying. So the actual flying time probably wasn't more than, what, 6 or 7 hours total. And the most you can schedule is 8 hours for a typical two-pilot crew. At least that's the way I understand the rules now. The crew duty day is somewhere, and there's a formula out there, and it may, I think it's an FAA rule, not an airline or contract rule, but it's usually around a 12-hour day, 12 to 14 hours. And even then, if we're going to go over that, and that's scheduled, anytime something happens, like you have a divert, et cetera, you make some calculations and you decide whether or not you are legally obligated to continue flying, or if you have the option of saying, I'm not going to continue to fly because I'm over this amount of crew duty day or whatever. But there are FAA limits as well, but it's, I don't know the exact number, but it's more than 14 hours. So, but there are cases where we could say, you know what, I feel pretty good. You ask your crew how they're feeling. You can extend beyond a certain amount of time and still be legal as far as the FAA is concerned and your contract is concerned. So this, it was probably a case of people thinking, you know, these people have been in Aruba all day long. Hey, I'd like to get home as well to my family. So I have some incentive to keep on flying, even though it's going to be a very long day for me. I want to get home, get to my bed, and be back with my family. So from what I can see, the time in this situation is not something that was illegal. But again, I don't have the exact rules and regulations regarding exactly how long they can fly, but it's quite a bit, actually. And I have been in situations where, you know, we were legally, as far as the FAA was concerned, able to fly longer, but one of the crew members said, I am not willing to extend beyond this contracted time that we've been on duty. And if you guys want to continue, you're going to have to find somebody else. And I hate seeing that. I really do. You know, I'm pretty mission-oriented. I want to do the best I can for my passengers. But there are times when my hands are tied and there's nothing we can do. And it's always so hard for me to make that announcement and say, hey, look, folks, we're turning into pumpkins up here. We're timing out. And, you know, we're hopefully going to have a crew come in and fly this flight to Atlanta or wherever we're going. Good luck to you, but we have to go to the hotel. And I chuckle, but it's kind of a nervous chuckle because I don't like letting people down like that. I really don't. And I think most of us are like that. So I'm glad you had a great vacation in Aruba. I'm sorry that it turned out as it did toward the end. One more question you asked there. I just was looking over your email. The captain came on the PA and alerted us that we were not able to push back because the flight plan had timed out. It used to be like 90 minutes past your scheduled departure time, but I think now that's been increased. I think the number is more like 3 hours. So if for some reason you're delayed and you want to fly the flight and still have your same clearance, you I think have a pretty generous amount of time. I think it's something close to 3 hours or right at 3 hours. What most crews will do if they know that the flight is delayed quite a bit is to designate one of the crew members to call up clearance delivery, one of the controlling agencies, and ask if their flight plan is still active and when it's going to expire. And a lot of times they'll say, hey, you're going to have to ask your dispatcher to refile the flight plan because it's about to expire. And then we give a call to our airport or airline headquarters and have our dispatcher refile, and then everything is fine. But in this case, perhaps they didn't think to check on the flight plan and see if it had timed out. And they were at that point in their pre-flight when they realized that it had, and they had to wait for the people at headquarters to refile. So that's all I can say about that. So, thanks again, Chris, for your feedback. Okay, I read that last week. So let me go through here and make sure that I got everything. There are a few pieces of feedback that I received in the last day or so. I'm going to save that for our next episode. So it is time for me to end the show. And talk about dedicated. I mean, I spent all this time. It's a beautiful day here in San Francisco. I mean, gorgeous. Clear skies, temperature in the mid-70s. I haven't been to San Francisco in forever, and I'm in my hotel room recording this podcast. It's because I love doing it, actually. But I can't wait to get out there right now and head over to Rogue Brewing Company, or maybe hit a little Vietnamese restaurant and get some good pho gan or something like that, and enjoy the city by the bay. So here we go. You too. You listening right now. Haven't you sent me feedback? Well, it's time you do. Feedback at airlinepilotguy.com. Or you can call my feedback line, 304-99-PILOT. That's 304-997-4568. Or you can go to my website, airlinepilotguy.com. Look over there on the right side. There's a little tab over there that you can click on, and you can send me some voice feedback that way. You can also hear, as one of my listeners who sent me feedback on the show did, you can listen to me on Stitcher Smart Radio. On-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone, your car, all kinds of stuff. Latest episode is always available to you. No syncing needed. I listen to a lot of podcasts via Stitcher myself because it's a little bit more compressed. Not as much bandwidth is used, and it saves data usage on your smartphone plan. So why don't you check it out? Stitcher. It's available for your iPhone, iPad, Android phones, and beyond. Downloading is easy. Go to stitcher.com/airlinepilot or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Until next time, take care and God bless.